We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us at the board this morning. Jason Croft, Harriet Williamson is our producer. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with historian Thomas Holt, and we will talk about a recently published book that he has authored. It's titled Children of Fire, A History of African Americans. Hill and Wang is the publisher. And he says that perhaps the driving theme of his book is that for most of their history, African Americans have sought recognition of their humanity as well as full and equal citizenship. At the same time, he says, there have been conflicting visions of African American history as people have struggled in the effort to claim both their black identity and also integration into the American mainstream. We'll try to talk a little bit about how these themes play out over time, all the way from the arrival of the first Africans in 1619 to the present. And, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest, Thomas Holt, is the James Westfall Thompson Professor of American and African American History at the University of Chicago, and he is joining us from there. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that would be good for anybody anywhere. You can hear us. The call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also send along email if you'd like to do it like that. will-talk@illinois.edu is the address. And Professor Holt, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
The story here is a grand sweep here. We've got hundreds of years of history. We have the American Revolution, the Civil War, Reconstruction, Civil Rights Movement. If you had to try and sum this experience in a few lines, could you do that? How would you do that?
Well, I took about 400 some pages to do this.
I realize that.
In a few lines, I think it became evident to me, actually toward the end of the book, what those lines might be. And I make frequent use of a scene I describe of Rosa Parks on the, very familiar to most people, on the refusing to surrender her seat on the Montgomery bus in 1955. Mm-hmm. And she later describes that as her motivation. Much had been attributed to her in various ways by historians and others. But she described it as that she was basically angry at how she and her people had been treated, and she was insisting upon being recognized as a human being, a citizen and a human being. And it seems to me those two, that phrase and those two concepts, citizenship and humanity, really captured much of the history of African Americans.
Mm. And it seems, as I think also you explain in the book, that for African Americans throughout the time that they've been here, there has been a struggle to think about, to define what part of them is African and what part of them is American. And from time to time, depending on who you asked, you're going to get a very different answer.
Right, right. That has, in that is reflected in different ways, actually. Mm-hmm. There's been, of course, a long history of an explicit identification with Africa, quite obviously from the very beginning, and when there were large numbers of Africans and people born in Africa in the population. It has been reflected later on in people like W.B. Du Bois, who made the famous statement that there was a double consciousness, that black people were both African and African American, and were trying to merge those two identities. And of course, it's been reflected in various Back to Africa movements, Marcus Garvey, black nationalist movements in the 20th century and continues to be. There's another sense, however, in which it's more than a specific African identity or an identification with the continent of Africa and a sense of an identification with the African diaspora, if you will, of peoples in many parts of the world, including Latin America, Caribbean, and even, to some extent, Europe and Asia. And that's a broader sense of claiming not so much a particular culture and a particular progeny, but, again, a sense of being a part of a larger humanity, an oppressed humanity. And that has played a parallel, if you will, had been a parallel theme in much of African-American writing and I think in a popular discourse of people who have no particular identification with Africa, the continent per se, but have this sense of, as Du Bois said, a double consciousness of being both a part of and apart from America. Mm.
One other sort of big issue that I'm interested in having you talk at least a little bit about here at the beginning is the challenge in writing this kind of history to acknowledge, on the one hand, to use some of the words you use here in the preface, the violent oppression and injustice that saturates the histories of Africa's descendants in the Americas, to acknowledge that fully, and yet at the same time to also acknowledge that it's not only that, that there is much more to the story than that, and that there are things that you can point to that are positive, so that you want to strike the appropriate balance between the two parts of the experience.
Yeah. That's exactly right in terms of the kind of conundrum or problem in trying to frame this history. As you say, and as I say in the book, you know, violence saturates the history from obviously the violent enslavement of Africans dragged in, across the Atlantic and the Middle Passage and subjugated in a horrendous labor system and social system of slavery and its aftermath. There's also the story of people responding to that oppression and overcoming it and trying to make sense of it and of their lives. And I think that's what I try to capture in the title, Children of Fire, which its origin is... 16th century Brazilian priest, a Jesuit priest, speaking to Brazilian slaves, and he's recorded as saying, "You are the children of God's fire. You are both. Your oppression has both illuminated you as well as consumed you." And that I read that many years ago, actually, when I started graduate school. And it's only actually in writing the book that I found that it resonated with something else that was a part of my memory that I had not sort of connected with it, which was another sermon, this one by an African-American in Albany, Georgia. That was one of the early cities of the Civil Rights Movement in 1960, 61, or 61, 62. A Reverend Gay was recorded. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had put out this documentary recording of many of the testimonies as well as sermons. And among the sermons was this sermon in which it says, you know, essentially the same thing as this Brazilian priest has said in the 16th century, that, you know, we are oppressed and we are, in effect, being consumed by the suppression, but we are also illuminated and we are made stronger by it. And it's a powerful theme. And as I thought about it, I found resonance of it in both popular songs and stories as well as among intellectuals, again, Du Bois, who talks about the oppression creating a second sight in African Americans. And so that was a way of trying to connect it in a, the two ends of the of that spectrum of both a horrendous oppression, experience of oppression, and yet not only survival but overcoming that oppression.
Our guest Thomas Holtz is a professor of American and African American history at the University of Chicago, and is author of the recently published book, Children of Fire, A History of African Americans. It is published by Hill and Wang, out in the bookstores now. I'm sure you can find it if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, at email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, something that I think that you just cannot get away from is that the two things. One is that people of African descent have been here, have been a part of America from the very beginning. And the other aspect of that is that they did not come here of their own choice.
Correct. There was a book by another Chicagoan historian named Lerone Bennett, many people may be familiar with, who wrote a book entitled Before Columbus. And he wrote a book in which he made the point that African Americans were here before the Mayflower, because the Mayflower, of course, landed in 1620. African Americans came in 1619. To drive home the fact that Africans have been a part of the creation and formation of this nation from its inception.
And maybe people would be surprised that, in fact, that it, as early as the date that we're talking about, 1619, there were I think technically speaking they were indentured, but that may be a small point, that there were Africans who were not free, who were here that early, and then of course became a very important part of the building of the country. Through I think another thing you really have to acknowledge is that just the contributions of their labor to establishing this country.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that if you look at it simply in economic, you know, statistical terms, the main source of wealth in the American colonies and then the United States, well into the early 19th century, was in southern agricultural produce, and particularly later on, cotton. The main source of labor for those products were African Americans. So in that very stark dollars and cents way, African Americans, of course, were contributing to the building of this country.
Yeah. Nowadays, we talk an awful lot about globalization and what that means for the economy of this country and other countries of the world. Well, at this time that we're talking about, there was a global economy involving people in Europe, in Africa, in the Americas, and slaves, black Africans who were enslaved, were a very important part of this, and people in Africa also participated in it. And I guess that's something that you certainly do acknowledge in the book and has to be acknowledged.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting, the interest in recent, I guess, decades, or recent decade in globalization, or the conjuring with that term. It's arguable that with the discovery of America and then with the production of goods in America that were, you know, traded back to Europe, and with African labor both in North America, in the Caribbean, and in South America being the principal source for the production of those goods, or the extraction of precious metals in the case of, you know, gold and silver in Latin America, that this was the first real globalization. that you had long-distance commerce that was beginning to develop out of the Mediterranean, in particular, at about the time and connected with the expansion or the discovery of Africa by Europeans and the contact with Africans by Europeans. They were simultaneous, and that but that the transatlantic trade really gave an incredible boost to a global commerce that would, of course, grow and continue with Eurasian as well as an Euro-American, a Europe-American connection.
Did it make a big difference, or in what sort of difference did it make that ultimately the European power in North America, at least, was Britain? And that at some point it passed from earlier on where the power on this side of the Atlantic was Spain.
Well, that's a huge question. the short answer is made a tremendous difference because of the differences in the nature of the Spanish Empire and of Spanish culture and so forth on issues, for example, of race. There are quite a bit of discussion and studies of the differences between Anglo-Saxon or Northern European ideas and attitudes about race versus those of the southern hemisphere or the southern Europe. It also made a difference in that, of course, Britain became not only a world naval and military power, but an economic power. Much of that, of course, happened after the American Revolution, but the continued connections and relationship of the new United States and Great Britain was important in the development of this country and the development of that again global economy. So, which might have been very different if it had been Spain, for example, that it sustained, or Portugal that it sustained its power into, say, the mid 19th century.
How did the numbers of slaves in the colonies grow, say, just from the point of the introduction of first Africans, so that 1619, up to the eve of the American Revolution?
Well, it's first of all, I think there's a tendency to, or has been, to elide the rather long history, colonial history, of slavery and its development in North America. As we said, slaves were introduced in 1619, the American Revolution at the end of the 18th century, and the abolition of American slavery in the mid-19th century. So the much longer period was the colonial period. And for the first, 80 years or so, or 70, 80 years, it was a very slow development. I mean, there were, and as was the North American, then British colonies, were very slow to get a foothold economically, say in comparison to Barbados, Jamaica, Brazil. And as a result, the growth of the labor force and of the numbers of African Americans was very slow. One of the things I point out in the book is that, contrary to the impression one often sometimes has, African Americans were in the 17th century, between 1619 and about 1700 or so, were but a small minority of the labor force. It was mostly white indentured servants, and which affected the nature of slavery. You mentioned earlier that some Africans were indentured labor. Well, actually, there wasn't a whole lot of difference in the way they were treated. And part of that is that they were a minority, whereas the bulk of the labor force were white indentured servants, and that sort of set the tone and the modes of treatment, punishment, and so forth. That changes in the 18th century when there's a tremendous expansion, rapid expansion of the numbers of slaves brought to the Americas generally, but in North America in particular. Most of the slaves came in North America came in the mid decades of the 18th century, which has all kinds of consequences in terms of not only the labor force, but social life, family life, culture, etc. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the U.S., along with the new nation of the U.S., along with Britain, cut off the legal slave trade in 1807, or 1808, it goes into effect, which has a further consequence in terms of, again, social life, labor, politics, etc. So the demography matters in its pattern, which is a kind of, you could sort of plot it as a kind of, a U-curve that rises and then falls.
We're just about at our midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest, Thomas Holt. He's a professor of American and African-American history at University of Chicago and is the author of a recently published book. The title is Children of Fire, A History of African Americans, published by Hill and Wang. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send your thoughts along by email if you'd like, That's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. I just recently have been reading a newly published biography of George Washington, and one of the things that strikes me, as has in the past, as I read about that period of American history, is how often the founders of the Revolution use the terms slave and slavery to in airing their grievances against Britain. You have to wonder, well, what exactly was in the minds of these men who, many of them, actually owned slaves? They knew what slavery really meant, and yet they could somehow use in that way that term, which seems to be not quite appropriate in that setting. Maybe you can talk a little bit more about the significance of slaves, of African Americans, not just slaves, but African Americans in the American Revolution.
Yeah. On the point of the founding fathers invoking slavery, and many of the most prominent leaders, of course, of the Revolution were Southerners, and many of them were slave owners. One argument has been made, actually, that far from being a kind of contradiction or an inconsistency, that since they owned slaves, they understood it very well and wanted to compare their condition to it in order to heighten the grievance that they felt, that they were being reduced to slavery. A similar thing happens during the Civil War, or just in the leading up to the Civil War, the debates on secession, or the sectional controversy, where, again, Southern slaveholders, claim that, well, Lincoln's going to enslave us, or the North is, bound to enslave us. And, of course, it's absolutely contrary to fact, as they well know, but the sense of utter degradation and subordination that they themselves have imposed upon African Americans is serving their cause to underscore the utterness, utter depravity of and horror of what they want to resist. So it's a curious kind of turn there. On the other hand, the very fact that they make these arguments open them up to both ridicule. I think it was Samuel Johnson who made the famous quip that, the loudest yelps for liberty are coming from slaveholders during the American Revolution. To ridicule on the one hand, but also to their own slaves saying, listening up, wait a minute, if you are claiming liberty and as your birthright, then what about us? And so it actually, the debates that they heard, and we have examples of this, debates that slaves heard in their own households as the Southern slaveholders railed against Britain, often encouraged them to cast their lot, first of all with the British in the Southern states, or In the case of the northern states, more often with the patriots, with the American side, the rebellious side.
And there, as you say, there were blacks who fought on both sides in the American Revolution, certainly not in the numbers that we saw in the Civil War, but that they did. And to what effect, particularly for those who thought that perhaps their situation would be better if they fought on the British side, it seemed that it didn't really turn out that way.
No, well, it's a mixed picture. The American Revolution was one of the first, it was not the first war in which slaves were involved, because slaves had been recruited to fight against Native Americans by, for example, in South Carolina, when they had various wars with Native Americans in that colony, in Latin America. So that was not unusual. But to be a slave population in the midst of a revolutionary war, a war fought on the grounds of claims to, again, of a common humanity and of basic human rights, was a very dangerous thing. And the American was one of the first large-scale events of that sort. You would have it again with Cuba in the mid-19th century. You would have it in the Latin American countries in the 1815-16, Venezuela, Colombia. In each case, both sides of the conflict found that they needed to appeal to the slaves. And the only effective appeal they could make was to give them their freedom, if you will fight on our side. Hmm. So the British very quickly recognized this. The American, the Patriot side, was slower because, again, a big part of its constituency were slaveholders. And the general of the army was George Washington, a principal slaveholder in Virginia. But even they came around to recognizing they would have to at least give freedom to some slaves that they recruited on their side as recompense for their service. The British, because the British were stronger in the southern states until Yorktown, they of course, were operating in the principal slave population. And so when they made their offer to grant freedom to those who would join their side or abandon the masters, of course, they got the larger numbers. So that's why that irony, it's not a historical accident, but a historical contingency, that the British would, in fact, be the first and perhaps the most numerous numbers of slaves would be found in the British colonies, in the southern colonies.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with him. They're somewhere in the Chicago area. We'll go there to our line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if Professor Holt's book covers this, but I'm interested in what he thinks the legacy is, the legacy of slavery is on the African-American male. I've heard that even there's lingering a lingering legacy of slavery on the relationship between African-American males and females, because slavery sort of emasculated the male, and so that there's a problem with the relationship between males and females because of this. What is your feeling about this?
I guess there are two points I would make. First of all, much is made about the legacy of slavery. But one has to remember that what followed slavery was a half century of subordination, economic, social, and political, disfranchisement, Jim Crow, and that any effects on the population in the 20th century and certainly the 21st century has to first go to that history before going to slavery, to find any roots for contemporary problems. Secondly, the picture of slavery as emasculating the slave male is certainly a controversial one at this point for historians. There's ample evidence, contrary evidence, of, I mean, first of all, obviously it did in fact, by its nature, subordinate, degrade, you know, male and female. But in terms of any particular impact on males that would be a lingering effect after slavery was abolished and into the post-emancipation period, that's a fairly, it's not really supported by the evidence as you look at what, in fact, males were able to do from fighting in the Civil War to the kind of political mobilizations that occurred after, during the Reconstruction, and a mobilization in which women were as, although women could not vote, were as active as the males. And so the, you know, finding those roots of whatever problems may have developed, whether it's family life and gender relations in slavery, I think is probably not going to be as fruitful as looking at what were the conditions in which people could make a living, and the conditions in which they could, again, claim their humanity, their citizenship in that post-slavery period.
So you think it might be more class-related than race-related?
Well, only in the sense that at least I would make the argument that economic security, economic wherewithal to make a living and to make a life affects all other parts of one's life, whether it's relationships with your spouse, with your children, and so forth, your community. So in that sense of a class relation, then I think that would be some merit.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think some of your comments you made in response to the question, I think, points to another big question, and that is, how did life for African Americans change? And how significant was the change, really, if you look at life before the war and before emancipation and then after?
Again, it's a complex question in the sense that life changed very dramatically and suddenly and unexpectedly, if you compare it to most slave systems. Once the slavery is abolished, what happens to the slaves? In the United States, they became citizens. They became voting citizens. They became members of Congress and two in the Senate. And then, of course, that progress was reversed. So it was not a linear kind of thing where, you know, there was a sort of a downward slope, but more of an up and down over the next several decades. As late as the 1890s, people were still very optimistic about the future. That is, African Americans were. Many were about the future of African Americans, and that they were a new generation coming into being, just coming into their own. They had established schools, for example. They had established people in professions. The declension, if you will, or the deterioration of black life really comes at the turn of the century, more so than in that period immediately after slavery. Mm. And it's related to a number of other developments that occurred during that period, including racial violence. It's too easy to say, well, you know, nothing changed, which is one of the, there's a temptation to say that in terms of the ways in which people were still not recognized as human beings, not citizens. But that would be to ignore that history in which there were moments of great promise that were dashed, it's true. But the argument can be made that they laid the basis for subsequent movements in the 20th century, both in terms of the constitutional changes that were drawn upon, like the 14th Amendment, for example, but also in terms of the kinds of institutions that were established. All of the black colleges, for example, most of them, that were established to train a new leadership were in this period of the immediate post-slavery period, the first couple of decades. And it's out of those colleges that you had the people who were, you know, at Montgomery and Selma and Atlanta and New Orleans in the Civil Rights Movement. And out of that, leadership developed. So it's a more complicated story than, you know, I think than at first glance it may appear.
Sure. Just to go for a moment back to the war, during the war and I suppose in some respects since, there are still people who want to argue about the role that slavery played. During the war, did people who were enslaved think that that war was about them?
At first they were uncertain, and they were uncertain for a very specific reason, that the Lincoln administration and the Union forces did not want the war to be about slavery. That was a hot button topic, if you will. And so there was an effort to deny that they were intent upon destroying slavery, because with good reason, they didn't feel that the majority of the northern public would support a war on that basis, as opposed to a war to preserve the Union. And so, as we see today, for very astute political reasons, Lincoln, you know, articulated the war aims in those terms. But that couldn't survive. It couldn't survive the war itself. It couldn't survive the what he himself called the exigencies of war, the necessities of war, that wore down that rationale, so that within 2 years of the war's beginning, you suddenly have a turn in which the war is explicitly about emancipation. But slaves themselves had recognized very early one of the themes running through the book is how ordinary people, you know, can seize the moment and make their own destiny, and can be astute, politically astute, about what's happening around them. And this is one of those moments where the slaves themselves recognized much earlier than certainly Lincoln and many others were willing to concede that, you know, this had to be ultimately the seed for the destruction of slavery. And they poured into Union lines, for example, seeking refuge and forcing the issue. So initially in June of 1861, no, it was not a war about slavery. And they were being told by their masters that the Yankees were simply going to take them and sell them to Cuba. There were prominent Union generals, Benjamin Butler from Massachusetts, who said that if the slaves rose up in rebellion, he would stop fighting the Confederates and fight the slaves. But all of that changed within a few months, within a few weeks, in fact. Butler himself would be one of the initiators of that change, when he recognized that when slaves escaped to his lines, he couldn't simply turn them back, you know, to their masters, because they were an important military resource for their masters. They were being used directly to build fortifications and ditches and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the slaves picked up on that, and tens of thousands of them, you know, came into Union lines and ultimately forced the issue that it had to be a war for emancipation.
Our guest, Thomas Holt. He's professor of history, American and African-American history at University of Chicago, author of the new book, Children of Fire, A History of African-Americans. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We do have a caller here who's been patient. We'll get right to them in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Was just going to ask one question, but I'd like to put a second one in that perhaps you could give some response to it. As this, the last few minutes you were talking about in terms of the change from preserving the Union to getting rid of slavery, and the 2 years that expire approximately. I sure don't remember anything like that in my high school history. I was wondering if this stuff's been caught up to date, you know, for the school children of today. The question I was going to ask originally was a more general one. You mentioned earlier about after the war was over and the Reconstruction period, the Southern politicians figured out ways to keep people in their place, and you mentioned the Jim Crow laws and stuff. I just wondered if you know this is a regular part and parcel of slavery, you know, in other places in the world when it's overturned in some way, that the original ruling class starts finding new ways to keep people sort of under their thumb. If you could talk about those two things, I'd really appreciate it. Very excellent program. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'll take the second question first, perhaps the most quicker answer. The answer is yes. And almost every slave system that was abolished found the powers that, since more often than not, the powers that that be, the ones who were in power before the abolition of slavery, remained in power afterwards or had a considerable influence, they've tried to find ways to limit the freedoms of the former slaves. Typically, this took the form more of economic controls, so that systems of labor, as happened in the United States with sharecropping, systems of labor were devised so that you would keep production going. You keep the staples being, you know, whether it was cotton or tobacco or sugar, which was the case in most of the hemisphere, would be produced. So that was sort of the standard narrative, if you will, for the what followed abolition. Now, there are variations within that, depending upon the particular politics of a place. For example, in Cuba, there was a Revolutionary War, which profoundly influenced, and actually, much as in the United States, at least briefly gave considerable recognition of citizenship of the former slaves who fought on the national side in that revolution. In Brazil, there was a change of the political system, which had an effect really of suppressing the political aspirations, at least for a while, of the former slaves. So there are variations, you know, historically, depending on where you are, which society one is looking at. But in general, there was an effort to keep people subordinated economically and by dint of that socially and politically as well. As to the first question, it's very interesting. The textbooks have been fairly slow, I think, to pick up the new narratives, new interpretations of periods like the Civil War and post and the period after abolition, and to reflect, you know, some of the things I've been talking about. But even more, I guess, disturbing or surprising, if you follow some of the recent news stories, there seems to be a move on the part of some people to turn the clock back even further. In my own, I'm originally from the state of Virginia, and my own state, the governor, of course, has made considerable waves recently by trying to what I would call, some would call, sanitizing the Confederacy. You know, that it was not about slavery. And then, of course, there was a textbook that's been roundly condemned, hopefully withdrawn at this point, that was going to try to make the case that, you know, blacks actually fought on the side of the Confederacy, which was, you know, being used to underscore that this was a fight for Southern independence and not a fight to preserve slavery. So, you know, we know the recent developments in Texas as well, which is a very big influence on textbook writing and textbook market. So for, I would say, not simply the professional historians, but, you know, people with children in the public schools or in schools, this continues to be an issue. And it's taken some surprising twist in this past few months, as far as how a period, a very important period in American history, is interpreted, not only in terms of its, the African-American aspect of that history, but the broader history of the nation as a whole.
We're down here to about 5 minutes left. In the beginning, I talked about how much history we're dealing with here, and we've only talked about, oh, maybe a couple of hundred years here. So I hope that people will go and will look at the book and will read the rest. Just for the last couple of minutes we have, I'm interested in maybe having you say at least a couple of things about the civil rights movement. And I noted down your the phrase you used in talking about an earlier period about how And this being a theme, though, that goes through the book, how ordinary people can seize the moment and take charge of their destiny. Certainly such a thing could be said of the civil rights movement, although at the same time, I think so often people think of the civil rights movement as just something that just sort of happened and don't really understand that this was something that did indeed develop over a period of time. And, you know, to take the case of Rosa Parks, it wasn't really the case that she just one day because she was tired, decided she was not going to give up her seat. This was a movement that involved a lot of people over a period of time and did involve thinking and planning. And it maybe wasn't as spontaneous as sometimes the story is told.
Yeah, it was in some sense both. One cannot understand the civil rights movement without understanding both a long tradition of struggle, and when you say tradition of struggle, you're talking about people. I mean, you're talking about people who would later become very important, both influencers and actors in the civil rights movement itself. People like Ella Baker, who had been involved in was born in the South, but had come of age really in the North and in various political campaigns in New York and in Harlem in particular, or people like Rosa Parks, who had not been as active a professional activist, if you will, as Ella Baker, who was an employee of the NAACP for a part of her life, her adulthood, but who had been also at various conferences, workshops and various campaigns that had been going on in Montgomery to register voters. Her husband had been active in the NAACP, and through him, she was drawn into its activities. So all that was preparation. She herself had had a session with a young woman, because there were many people like Rosa Parks, several people at least, who had been arrested for defying the segregation laws in Montgomery buses. And there had been discussions about bringing their cases to court, and for various reasons, some of them had not panned out. One of those was a young woman, about 15-year-old, that Rosa Parks herself had at a meeting to introduce her to NAACP officers just a few months, and I think it was May or June of the year before she was arrested that December. So all that was preparation, and she was very much involved. But there was also the spontaneity of it. Mm-hmm. And I speak to this because in some sense this book also comes out of my experience, which was my formative experience was also in the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. That at a certain moment, it resonates with me when she says, you know, she was sitting there, she was going home, you know, from work, and while she had this history of activism and awareness, and particularly of the recent killing of Emmett Till, the lynching of Emmett Till, which had happened just a few months earlier, all that came together at that moment. It wasn't as if she were planning, because there were test cases and people planned to challenge the laws, the segregation laws, but she wasn't really planning it. It was spontaneous in that sense. And I think that speaks to the movement as a whole, that there was a long history of preparation. There were a number of social forces that made it an optimal moment to challenge the segregation laws. That is, beyond individual lives, changes in the economy, changes in law and government and the attitude of the federal government and so forth. But it took a given, moment in which it all crystallized for an individual that I cannot put up with this anymore. This has to stop. And I think that's what happened with Rosa Parks. Yeah. And so one has to recognize both of the conjunction of both of those forces.
Yeah. And just I do want to acknowledge that the approach you have taken is in writing the book is to try to do a story of people and their experiences. And I think you note rightly so that while historians might like to divide history up into convenient sorts of packages, that's not the way people experience it. So I want people to come away with the idea that this is a story of people and how they experience these events.
Thank you very much for saying that, because that is and has been one of the driving forces in my trying to frame and to write this book. That realization that sense comes out of my own experience. I talk about it in the book a bit in the preface of looking at my own father's life, which he was born in 1917. He was in World War II, served in the Pacific, and lived to see, you know, the civil rights movement and its successes, and to be a participant in it. But he, you know, came of a family that were involved in the Southern agricultural system, and he lived to see the demise of that system as well. And so, that was the sort of source for my rethinking how to present. Present this narrative, because it is a story of the African American people.
Well, the book is "Children of Fire: A History of African Americans." Hill and Wang is the publisher, and our guest is the author Thomas Holt. He's James Westfall Thompson Professor of American and African American History at University of Chicago. We want to thank you very much, Professor Holt, for being with us.
Well, thank you.
And also want to say thanks to Eric Fay. He's the technical director at the other end of the connection there at University of Chicago. We appreciate your time very much, Professor Holt.
Okay, thank you.